If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today on this beautiful Saturday. It is gorgeous outside, my friends, and if you have not gone outside yet, please make a point to do so, because we have to enjoy all this weather while we can. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking about those wonderful patios in Chicago that we love so much, that we live for all year long, speaking of good weather. But first, let's talk a little bit about e-commerce. We have so much to talk about, but let's start there today. You know, there's like this kind of list, right, on e-commerce websites like Amazon, and you see the list price, but then you see the retail, and then you see what it's discounted for, and you think you're getting this deal, and then other sites have it marked up differently, and it's really kind of confusing. And there's some people with the patience to comparison shop that might notice some discrepancies, and people kind of shop for the best deal versus how quickly you can get it and all that kind of good stuff, and it gets really overwhelming. Well, we're kind of in a moment with e-commerce. So here joining us on the program now is David Streitfeld from the New York Times, who wrote about this fictitious list of prices on e-commerce sites like Amazon and original prices that have sort of been knocked down to the actual price. So you think you're getting a deal, but in fact, not really so much at all. Welcome to the program, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Well, so break all this down for us, because I think people think about this in terms of, you know, there are people with the patience to get the best deals, and there are people that just go to Amazon and get whatever it is. But it's really much more complex and quite fraught with issues.
Yeah, let me give you an example, and maybe that'll help. I'm looking at Amazon now, and they have an offer for a set of kettlebells, you know, those weights that you lift to increase your strength. And they say that they'll sell it to you today for $162, and that's a bargain because the list price is $250. And so you look at that and think, gosh, I need to get my body in shape, it's going to be summer soon, and I'm going to save $88. And so you think, that's a good deal, and you click. But if you went to, as I just did, to the actual manufacturer's site where they sell these kettlebells, their price that they're selling it for is $160, actually a dollar or two cheaper than Amazon. And so Amazon, and it's just typical of other sites, it is trying to compel you to buy right now by telling you something that, to my way of thinking, isn't quite true.
Right. And I think there, you know, it's interesting psychology there, right? Because we think we're getting such a good deal. I think there's probably, if we were to test people and A/B test them, of someone buying a product for $160 versus buying something that was $162 but marked down from $200, I think people respond to that idea that they're getting a deal, that they have somehow fought the system and won something. But then they also factor in like shipping, and I think Amazon makes it so easy to get something so quickly. Do you get the sense that people are willing to pay those couple of dollars more for speed?
I think people might be willing to do that. And I think e-commerce, especially at Amazon, is shifting to a model where you don't think about the price that much. But one reason with Amazon you don't think about the price is that for most of the 15, 20 years of its existence, it has placed a lot of emphasis on being cheap. So it has a great reputation for being cheap and offering you a great deal. And so I think when people see that list price and the heavy discount, and they think, I'm going to get it tomorrow, and they know with Amazon, if they have any complaints, they'll take it back, no questions asked, all of that compels them to buy. And, you know, Amazon is a great site in many ways. It concentrates on treating the customer well. But I think it's encouraging people here to do something. It's saying something about price that, again, isn't really true, because you are not going to find those kettlebells for the list price of $250 many places, if any. It just doesn't exist. It's in Amazon or whatever retailer is saying it's discounted. It's just encouraging you with something that is not quite accurate.
And not quite the deal it seems like. So, I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be illegal, but does it step into a gray area of legality?
It's certainly in a gray area. The FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, which regulates this, drew up its rules 40 years ago, long before the internet was a dream in anyone's eyes as a place to shop. And their rules are actually fairly strict about this if you project them into the future. I mean, they say a list price has to be something that the product is actually sold at, and it's got to be more than one store. It's got to be widely sold at that. But it seems like a gray area of enforcement. The regulators just aren't interested in talking to the retailers about it for whatever reason.
So do we think that perhaps it's time that, you know, since, as you pointed out, these regulations were drafted way pre-internet, is it time to update them? I mean, I think with so many things, we often find ourselves saying, well, the law hasn't caught up with the realities of the online world. And is this one of those examples?
It's probably time to update them. And in the meantime, I think people on whatever site they are should not make the automatic assumption that they made for years, that here I am buying on the internet, it is by definition a bargain. In the real world, people don't necessarily trust retailers. They don't trust most retailers when they go into a physical shop, and they should probably apply that to online stores as well.
Certainly. Well, in the story that you wrote for New York Times, you write that e-commerce is in flux. So what is down the road here around this issue?
I think what's down the road is what companies, what the retailers want you to do is they want to replicate the model of someone like Costco or the old department stores like Sears of 50 years ago, where you have an account there and you do as much shopping as possible there. And to go along with that, you don't really think about price, or price isn't possible to think about. I mean, Amazon gives you free movies. Do you add 10 cents or take away 10 cents from every object you buy to account for those movies? Maybe if you didn't like the movie, you don't take away anything. But so it's just hard to know how much you're really paying for things, which is a position that is good for a retailer, not so good for someone who is watching their budget or wants to be conscious of where every dollar is going.
Right. And then it becomes very time consuming, you know, to go through all these different sites and to go to the manufacturer, go to the retailer, you know, go to all those places. But, you know, it reminds me of the same narratives around buying airline tickets, because sometimes you can get a great deal on Priceline or whatever, but sometimes you can also go right to the site and get, you know, right to that airline site and get a even better deal.
You can, and that's something, the more expensive it is, people would want to check out. I mean, obviously, if it's a pair of socks or something real cheap that you're throwing into a basket of stuff you're buying anyway, you're not going to check that much. And so people have to decide what their line is. But the main issue is don't automatically assume everything is as cheap as you're being told it is.
Indeed. All right, David Streitfeld, thank you so much for joining us today on the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right, my friends, go to NewYorkTimes.com and check out Some Online Bargains May Only Look Like One that he wrote there. Very, very interesting the way he breaks it down. All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are talking about those wonderful outdoor patios and restaurants around the city. You know them, you love them, and it's almost time to use them. A day like today, it seems like we can. We'll be right back here in just a bit on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Sous 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us on this lovely day. I hope you are listening from outside because it is so beautiful outside today. You have to enjoy it. And you know what, my friends, I have long, long said one of my very favorite things about Chicago is that because the winter is so miserable sometimes, that as soon as it's warm, we go outside and we live like it is our last day on earth. And we carpe the diem fully. And so part of that, of course, is those wonderful restaurant patios that we cannot resist when the weather is warm. And some brave souls even will put on a parka and go brave them just because it's warm enough to possibly deal with them. And so here to talk about that is Chicago Tribune's Samantha Baumkamp. Welcome to the program, Samantha.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Always glad to have you on the show. All right. Well, so, you know, we had kind of a weird March. We had, you know, where we had like a lot of, you know, we had a lot of weird days and it just didn't seem like a typical March. And the start to April seems certainly weird because we had a bunch of snow just as you know, as late as last week. And so it seems like it's kind of thrown some of the local restaurants, you know, thrown their plans off a little bit as far as their timelines, because I think they really depend on those patios, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But with a little heat lamp, Chicagoans seem to be willing to brave it. I mean, you can just wear a jacket and sit outside, and it's seemed completely worth it to us.
Right, right. And people do. I've seen people knock snow off chairs and park themselves on a patio. So a lot of restaurant groups use that patio as kind of a billboard. They, you know, they want to entice people to go in. And it's, I think, a very effective one because it's hard to kind of get the vibe of a restaurant when you're just walking by it in the winter. But in the summer, you kind of see what people are eating. You see how people are dressed. You can kind of get a sense of the dress code and how fancy or not fancy it is. Right. And so what are we seeing kind of a slow start to the season because of the weather, or is this, or are we still kind of on target?
Well, that's really interesting part when you mentioned the billboard. That's one of the things I didn't really expect to hear as much when I was reporting on the story, is that a lot of restaurateurs talk about it as such an important factor of the energy of the restaurant, of kind of bringing the outside in. But it makes total sense when you think about it, because we don't want to go into some dark, you know, candlelit restaurant, for instance, when it's 70 degrees outside. So not only is it a huge deal when it comes to sales, I mean, it can boost sales significantly for just the cost of a $600 permit, but it can also just lure people in when they otherwise would have gone to the beach.
Right. And I think, too, there's an interesting point you make in the story you wrote at ChicagoTribune.com about this, about labor, because, you know, a lot of restaurants will hire up and get a lot more staff to work in the summertime, you know, spring and summer when it's warm, simply because there are more tables to deal with. And I think a lot of servers count on having a little bit bigger sections, making a little bit more money. I know, long time ago when I used to wait tables, there was certainly, we used to kind of fight over who got the patio because that's where you usually made the most money because everybody wanted to sit outside. So there's labor issues too, both for the employees trying to plan around, okay, this is about when I start making more money or start getting more tables or something like that, as well as for the restaurant managers who are, you know, have maybe just made a push to hire some extra staff, maybe some extra people to bus tables and turn them over quickly, things like that, in addition to servers. And perhaps even kitchen staff to keep up with the demand of suddenly a lot more tables, and suddenly you have kind of people sitting around. You don't have the business yet to accommodate that.
Right. There's just been an army of new hires among the restaurants in Chicago. You know, across the country as the weather gets warmer, but especially here because we're so rabid about our patios. You know, staffing, depending on the size of the restaurant, can jump by a third at this time of year. And, you know, throughout February and March, depending on when the weather really starts to get nice like it is today, the restaurants really, they rely on the weather to guide them as far as, you know, giving extra shifts to existing wait staff and bartenders, but also hiring new ones. But the other interesting factor in this is, as you mentioned, the weather is so unpredictable in Chicago. Although a permit lasts between March and December, they may only get 75-100 good days out of it. So relying on data from previous years and then just ultimately, you know, crossing your fingers and hoping the rain doesn't come is a constant kind of struggle for these restaurant groups.
Definitely. You talked to someone in this story that you wrote for ChicagoTribune.com about who has restaurants around, you know, lots of cities, but that person notes how important, you know, and how kind of a crapshoot Chicago is, but how important it is because to kind of shake off that cabin fever, you know, as we said earlier, how it, you know, people really count on that. People really, really count on having their summertime outdoor patio time that, you know, is a psychological factor in this city when people do kind of feel very cooped up by the time winter starts to roll on. So it'll be interesting to see kind of what this quarter returns look like as we come back after such a strange, very strange weather pattern this spring. It'll be very interesting. All right, my friends, Everybody head to ChicagoTribune.com. Check out this story that Samantha Baumkamp wrote all about the patios and the outdoor dining. And certainly on days like today, go out there and support your local restaurants because they need you. They need you so much with all the cruddy weather we've had. Thanks so much, Samantha. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
All right. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and then we're going to get you to news. And when we come back, still plenty of stuff to talk about, including a $700 juicer. Would you buy that? Let's talk about it. All right, here, we'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us on this beautiful Saturday afternoon. I hope you are able to enjoy this beautiful sunshine before the day is out. Soak it up while we can, my friends. We gotta love the summer as we get closer and closer, creeping up to summer. We gotta love it here in Chicago, especially after this winter on all the gray skies. We gotta love it and gotta appreciate it and gotta soak it in while we can. All right, my friends, still plenty to do here today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking about a $700 juicer. And I would love to get your thoughts on that because that seems a little much, but we're going to talk all about that. But right now we are joined by Janet Novak, who is the Washington Bureau Chief for Forbes and the Personal Finance Editor. Welcome to the show, Janet.
Delighted to be with you.
Thanks so much. Well, you wrote there's a very interesting piece at Forbes, and it's all about the best and worst jobs for baby boomers that is really, really interesting. And it's kind of based around the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. They created this index rating almost 1,000 occupations on how susceptible performance is to age-related declines in ability, which is such an interesting thing to think about. And I think especially as we see more people retire and then go into a second career, or where we see people maybe not yet retiring who, you know, during the economic downturn had to kind of change directions or look for different work or things like that. It is a really, you know, an interesting piece. So kind of take us through this a bit.
Well, they wanted to look at 52 specific abilities, or which the government actually rates these 954 jobs by how much each of these 52 abilities, cognitive, physical, psychomotor, which is sort of eye-hand coordination, how much these things decline. So they looked at all the literature and tried to figure out how much do they decline, how much is each skill needed in each job. And by combining the two, the skills needed, according to the federal government, and how much they decline, according to a literature review, they were able to say, oh, you can't be a dancer at 60. It's really hard to be a roofer at 60 because certain physical abilities, such as balance, go before such abilities as simple strength. You can lift things, but you can't jump. And your balance is going. And when it comes to white-collar jobs, first of all, some white-collar jobs, such as surgeon and dentist and pilot, require either fine motor skills or a very quick reaction time. And those are things that tend to go in your early 60s. But other jobs that are white-collar really depend on the sort of cognitive abilities that can even continue growing through your 60s. And those are reading and writing and thinking and talking. So you can teach on your 60s and 70s, but you can't necessarily fly a plane if you were a commercial pilot. So some of this, when you look at it, you go, wow, that's obvious. And then they took these ratings and they looked at how they how people had to wear different jobs retired. And sure enough, they found a statistically significant impact among this sample that they used of on retirement age of what job you have. So if you have a white-collar job that skills may decline in your early 60s, well, you're more likely to have retired by 65 than if you have one of those jobs that the skills don't decline.
Interesting. So perhaps we'd see more, say, as you mentioned the example of pilots. We might see pilots retiring a little early in their 60s, whereas say a professor or something might continue for quite a bit long after the, you know, standard 65 and a half retirement age.
Right. And this is really significant because of all the debate over how do we make Social Security solvent.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, there's been a discussion of let's raise the retirement age, both the normal retirement age and the early retirement age at which you can take reduced benefits. The current normal retirement age is 66 going to 67. The earliest you can get retirement benefits is 62. So there's, let's raise it to 63 or 64, and if we have to, we can make exemptions for some blue-collar workers. Mm-hmm. But it turns out there are, yes, blue-collar workers, by and large, end up retiring earlier and have skills that decline earlier. But there are some white-collar jobs that actually are more susceptible to aging than certain blue-collar jobs. With proper training and conditioning and exercise, some of your physical abilities, your ability to lift, your stamina can be preserved. And so you can continue to do, you can be a cook, but you can't necessarily drive a truck. Why? Because night vision goes early, and that's one of the things that as of now we can't adequately correct for. So it's fascinating. And as you said when we started out, excellent point that if you're looking at a second career, look at one that will actually last you. But another use of this study is to say, okay, I'm in a profession that may have some liability to age. Can I take training? Can we adjust my job? Can I move laterally in such a way that my performance will continue to be tip-top? Now, of course, none of this looks at age discrimination or whether you're in an industry that the jobs are disappearing. So, for example, you could be a reporter or an editor and be aging, and that's fine. You just might not have a job.
Right.
That is because of industry decline. On the other hand, if you're a photographer, you may have trouble doing your job as well at 65 as you did at 55.
It
because
is
of some of the visual things.
Right, right. I mean, it is a really interesting one. And immediately as I was reading it, I started having that same thought of, I wonder if this is going to create some you know, kind of worsen the ageism stigma and you know, if it's going to, reinforce some beliefs that I think a lot of people have anecdotally about aging. But then on the other side, I wonder if it makes sense for us to kind of adjust what we consider a standard retirement age for different fields.
And of course, we already have that in the sense that professors have tenure and they don't have to retire at 65. Mm-hmm. And pilots do have to retire early. So some of the most extreme cases, we already have adjustments for. But I think it is useful. Will it increase discrimination? No, because I think that to the extent that people have conceptions about aging people, they already have them.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, this is very positive because it points out that you're hearing. To the extent that people have hearing loss, it doesn't generally happen until after 70. And all of these cognitive skills, vocabulary can still be growing in your 60s. So it points out that there's a whole range of jobs that people can do just as well in their 60s as they could in their 50s, 40s, 30s. And then there are others that can't. And it doesn't mean everyone can't do them. Some people, you know, are extraordinary, run marathons in their 80s.
Definitely. You know, in my own family, I've had several relatives that have made it to 100. And I think that that is absolutely true, just from my own observation in my own family, that is absolutely true of the cognitive abilities that continue on far past retirement age. I mean, my grandfather's nearly 100, and he says the secret of a long life is to try to learn something, always be learning something new. So I think that is a very good point to make, and perhaps it'll maybe have an opposite effect of ageism and make us have a little more respect for someone who has been on the planet a long time and has observed many things and perhaps has wisdom to share.
That's true. And I think it helps us decide about that new career. I think you've got the best point of all.
I mean, I think it is one to really take into consideration, right? I mean, I think it maybe a second career is more with cognitive skills and less about motor skills or something like that. So it is very interesting. There's a lot to think about here. So everybody, head to Forbes.com and check out this story. It's called The Best and Worst Jobs for Aging Boomers. Janet Novak, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking about an unbelievably expensive juicer. I'm talking a $700 juicer. Would you pay $700 for a juicer? I don't know if I would. We're going to talk all about it here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. My friends, there's lots of gadgets you can get for the kitchen. Lots of unitasking kind of gadgets that only just do one thing. And some of them are fine, some of them not so much. But what are your thoughts on a $700 juicer? Kind of like with the little pods that you put in, you know, like the Nespresso or the Keurig. $700 for a juicer? Is that a thing? Is that just solving a problem that is a very super high affluent first world problem? Is that Silicon Valley doing that again? We shall see. Joining us now on the show is Kate Nibbs from Gizmodo, who has written about this juicer with a headline that I found delightful, and that is, the only thing dumber than buying a $700 juicer is investing in it. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. So talk us through this a bit. So this startup, it's for this juicer. It's called the Juicero, and it's essentially a $700 Keurig for cold pressed juice that is organic and quite fancy. But as this is going on, not only have they raised a ton of money with kind of that argument that kind of invest up front and it's better in the long run, it looks like that theory has been disproved quite quickly, that in fact even the most expensive juice doesn't even come close to covering just the cost of the little pods.
Yeah, the pods themselves they're pouches actually, so a little bit different from Keurig, but the same concept. They're like $5 to $10, so they're expensive on their own. That's the price of just going out and buying a juice many times, you know. So I don't think that there's a great argument for value. I think that they do have a good argument that they're making really nice fancy juice. So if you want really fancy juice, it's not a bad product. But I just am really taken aback by the fact that it got $120 million in investment.
Indeed, that is a ton of money, $120 million. Think about what you could do with $120 million. And, you know, it's not an imperative that every single startup necessarily solves the world's crises. It is a little bit hard to justify $120 million for a, you know, to solve a very fancy juicing problem when we do have people starving that don't eat breakfast and lunch and dinner every day, you know, that people that can't even find food every single day. It is a little bit hard to break that off. And, you know, it in the story that you have on Gizmodo, you even mentioned Gwyneth Paltrow, I think, who gets a lot of grief for, you know, when she tried to live off of food stamps, she, you know, bought organic bok choy and limes and, you know, all kind of things. And I mean, is this really just the latest example of Silicon Valley investing in products that will be dazzling for other people in Silicon Valley?
I think it is. I want to pick on Juicero. Like, there's nothing inherently wrong with a fancy juicer, but it is just such a good example of a product that really only appeals to very wealthy people, and it's just getting this money dumped on it, and it just really, you know, galvanizes questions of why are we choosing to invest our money this way? It's, yeah, no juice is worth it.
No. No juice is worth a $700 juicer, I don't think. So, you know, I immediately think of, you know, probably a year or two ago, there was a list that came out that was all about, you know, kind of who was working at all these venture capital firms. So it seems like a very inside baseball. It's solving a problem using inside baseball for the people playing the inside baseball. You know, I think it's that very thing. You know, and you point to some other examples in this story. There was kind of the idea of a Uber for helicopters, if you feel like you need to charter a helicopter. And there was, you know, BarkBox, which I'm not super familiar with that one, but it seems like high-end dog treats and on-demand home massage startups and things like that. Whereas I think, you know, especially the ones around transportation are a little tricky when there's, you know, just the idea of getting, you know, the weekly pass to be on the train can be a financial hurdle for some people and some things people have to budget for carefully. So it does, I mean, to me, it just kind of points at this great disparity of between the very wealthy and the not very wealthy, the people that are quite concerned about money and struggling. And again, you know, as we look at who is running the venture capital firms that are doing this investing, it just seems like it's populated by it's not a very diverse perspective coming to the table around these things. So this really just kind of is more of a symptom of some issues in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes, you know, I don't want to pick on BarkBox either. There's nothing inherently wrong with the subscription service for dog treats. But then when you see, you know, all of the really frivolous startups, you know, when you look at them and see how much money they're getting and the fact that there are so many of them, there's like four or five different variations of Uber for helicopter. And you see like how central startups that focus on fixing imaginary problems for rich people are. It does make it pretty clear that there's something wrong with the way that Silicon Valley is investing its money.
So how do we fix that? You know, those of us who are outside of Silicon Valley, obviously there's the don't buy it, don't fund it option, you know, don't mm-hmm. give them your dollars. But what else can really be done to change the culture in Silicon Valley of getting more and more exclusive? And I don't mean exclusive in the positive fancy way, you know, in the special way. I mean exclusive in the excluding people from the from the narrative there. Oh, did I lose you there, Kate?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go.
Sorry.
So, you know, what can be done there to fix that, to change the tide and the way things are in Silicon Valley?
I wish I had a good solution, but besides getting more diverse voices in the companies that are making these investments and in the companies that are making these products, the only thing that I've thought to do is just raise these kind of questions and try to spark a conversation so at least people are aware that there's a problem. Because if you don't take a step back and look at the fact that this isn't just a fancy juicer, it's $120 million thrown at a fancy juicer. Right. And nobody, you know, if people don't stop and say, hey, is that such a good idea? It's going to keep happening.
Right. And I think we risk it becoming a thoughtless status symbol as opposed to a symbol of a symptom of some major cultural issues in the startup world. So, well, yes. Thanks for breaking it down for us. Thanks so much for joining us today, Kate.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great day. All right. Everybody head to Gizmodo and read about this. The headline of the story is the only thing dumber than buying a $700 juicer is investing in it. And it really kind of takes a look at some of the first world problems in Silicon Valley. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, and turn you over to King John here in just a bit on 720 WGN.